It's time for the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast, answering your questions from the General's Quarters every week, right here on VolQuest.
Hey, good Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome into the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast, presented as always by our friends over at Exterior Home Solution, local and trusted since 1999. If you have a need for roofing, siding, garage, whatever that case may be, contact Exterior Home Solutions today. That phone number is 865-524-5888 or online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. I'm Eric Kane, alongside Austin Price, Grant Ramey, and Brent Hubbs. Got a full bank of questions, and we'll jump down into it. We'll start with WiseVol24. DeSamp has had an amazing year, but it looks like to me he doesn't have that top-end speed that he had last year. Does he have an injury? He's been caught from behind three or four times this year.
I mean, he hurt his ankle in the Alabama game and went in the injury tent for a couple of minutes. And
second quarter.
And got taped up and kind of limped it off on the sideline and walked it off and got back. So I don't think he has an injury per se when you look at that. You know, he had a long run of 80 yards in 2022, which was his freshman year, and I think that was in mop-up duty.
Vanderbilt game.
He had a long run. Yeah, it was the Vanderbilt game. You're right. Same difference.
Everybody had an 80-yard run that night.
They did.
True.
In 23, he had a 44-yard run, and this year he's got a long of 56, and I think another 50-yard run. So I don't think there's anything any different. I mean, the long run he had the other night, Alabama had the angle on. The long run Grant against Arkansas, he almost came to a stop to make the safety miss and bounce outside them and then restarted. So, no, I don't think he's suddenly a lot slower or anything like that.
No, I mean, he's on pace for like 245 carries. I'm sure he's not 100% healthy because he's averaged 20 carries a game and we're, what, six, seven games into this thing. So, no, I don't think he's 100% healthy. Just I don't think anybody is at this point in the season, but getting ran down or not, as productive as he has been, I have zero issue with anything going on with Dylan Sampson because he's been that impressive consistently all season.
Yeah, he's got about 40 more carries than the second most guy in the SEC right now. I mean, he's been a true workhorse, that's for sure. Let's go to JD Vol 98. Do you think Oklahoma comes after Halsey in the offseason for their vacant OC spot? Would he be interested or would he remain loyal to Josh Heupel, Austin?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think he would go anywhere. But, I mean, you know, it is his alma mater. And, you know, is it a better situation than he has here? I would tell you no. They're not as good at the quarterback spot, whether it be now or the future. And that one just would be more of a head-scratcher to me if that happened.
And I don't know what kind of relationship he and Brent Venables have. I mean, yeah,
if one at all.
I think Brent Venables, Grant's got to go hire a proven commodity.
Yes.
With where he's at in his tenure at Oklahoma, I don't think you can go with quoted experiment. And I think most people fairly, you know, unfairly or whatever, believe that this is Josh Heupel. If you're the offensive coordinator at Tennessee, you're helping call some plays, but this is ultimately Josh Heupel doing what Josh Heupel does. I don't think that Brent Venables can afford to go a direction like that.
No, it feels like it's his last strike. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of Oklahoma football or how hot that seat is, but he's not going to get a chance to make a lot more hires based on the current situation, it seems like, at least.
It certainly feels like, you know, I think Oklahoma, more so than Texas, is probably going to be a little bit more patient, but it's how they're losing, not that they're losing, in my opinion. It's the fact that Hub said this, and, you know, it's true. They panicked with the freshman quarterback because he got in there and ran around against Tennessee's fifth and sixth best linebackers in the fourth quarter and made a few plays with his legs. Like, since then, he's done nothing. It's kind of like when Brian Maurer hit the 80-yard bomb to Marquez Callaway and everybody went, ooh, and then after that, it was just nothing, right?
So, when you got off script,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, so they've kind of – We've all seen it before, you know, with quarterback situations. When you make the wrong decision or knee-jerk something, sometimes it can totally throw the whole thing off kilter.
Well, and they're not going to win much down the stretch.
No. I mean,
with their schedule. They got a lot of long days, it looks like, still coming. Because I don't think inserting Jackson Arnold back into the lineup is suddenly going to change their fortunes offensively with where they are. They lack playmakers. they've been beat up, Eric, and they have a hard time scoring. I don't think that's suddenly going to get fixed when you look at who all they continue to have to play and the cumulative effect of playing everybody every weekend. I didn't look at the schedule, but I wonder how many times Oklahoma's lost after the Red River rivalry, because typically that's probably a pretty easy game for them scheduled after that, after the Texas game. And all that those two teams did, one played Georgia and one played South Carolina. Welcome to the SEC. There are no off days. There are no layups. There's no gimmies. And they're going to find that out down the stretch for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't dove into the stats on Oklahoma like we did leading up to that game. But last I checked, not a run game. Last I checked, receivers are still beat up. Last I checked, quarterback situation obviously is very much in flux. So regardless if it's Arnold or if it's the freshman, Hawkins, it's like you don't have much of a band to work with. It's just kind of been that way all year long due to injuries or whatever. I mean, the lack of a traditional run game has really hurt them in a massive way. And they didn't have that leading up to Tennessee, and they don't have it now.
The only reason they're not 2-5 instead of 3-4 is because Auburn is equally as bad, if not worse, at quarterback, which made that pick six made them 2-5 instead of 3-4.
Auburn just continues to find a different way to lose every week.
I had one person nationally suggest to me, if he were to lose to Kentucky this week and Vanderbilt at home next week, he might be in a really world of hurt.
Where are they getting all the money at? Because they're still writing $20 million checks to Gus, right? They made him send him away with a $22 million check.
I agree with you. Here's the problem is, like, they have went and bought this recruiting class, and no, that's no shade. That is what it is. A lot of schools do it. Tennessee's had their success in denial with high school kids. But, like, when you're struggling on the field, it's unrealistic to think these high school kids are going to come in and flip it around. To me, you've got to flip it in the portal. So they had better be big spenders in the portal as well. If they're counting on, you know, Deuce Knight and a bunch of 17, 18-year-olds to come in and flip the script next year, I think they may be sadly mistaken.
I think we've come full circle here, though, that Hugh loses his next two games, gets fired, Brent Venables, he walks to Norman, and there we go. We're good. Since they're already the Spider-Man meme.
Brent, they're not still paying him now, right? Because Gus has a job.
No, but he got a big. I mean, he got a big check. I mean, they had to write it all. They had to write a big lump sum check early. No. I mean, they're not paying him mitigation. They're not paying him annually, but like they owed him a ridiculous amount of money, like 30 days after he left. They've spent. My point is, they've spent a ton of money, and do you turn around and spend a ton more money? Because I guarantee you, Hugh Freeze's buyout's not small. So. That would be interesting to see, you know. And again, they had that game sewed up at Missouri and just couldn't get it done. They were one snap away, and that's kind of been them all year. I mean, they've given more games away than anybody has in the country.
It's an Earl Derrick Dooley type giving away of games, too.
Vol through it all. I'm curious about your thoughts on the reversal of the pass interference call in the Georgia-Texas game. I've never seen a pass interference call reversed like that. I know the referees cannot look at the scoreboard replay. Do you think the SEC office told the officials that it was the wrong call during the delay, causing the fans to throw bottles on the field? Also, I thought only Tennessee fans threw stuff on the field. What kind of precedent do you think this causes moving forward?
You better put some foul ball nets up in front of student sections.
Oh, yeah. You better put them up all the way around the field.
Stop the bottles.
Because it's not just students that are hurling things. It's coming from a lot of different places. I think it's a horrible precedent because that's not a reviewable call, right? I mean,
right.
So I think it's and of course the SEC is never going to make a statement of anything about it or but like that is a dangerous deal that we're going to call it one way. And come back and change a call and say, well, we got some number wrong or what? I mean, listen, I'm not defending Kirby Smart or anything, but he had every right to be livid and every right to come unhinged. And I'll give Lane Kiffin said this week, he was like, Kirby handled it better than I did, I think, which is pretty remarkable. But I mean, that is a dangerous precedent to set that you're just. It's like the old Buffalo Wild Wings commercial, right? This guy hit the button. Hey, you know what's going to happen here? That's what it felt like. It is not a good look for the league. It's not a good precedent to set in any way, shape, or form. That's one that cannot happen again. You cannot allow that to happen.
I mean, forget the bottle throwing for a moment. How often do officials conference and change a call? Pretty rarely. How often do they make a call, mark it off, and it looks like you're ready to go, and then conference, and then change it, and then walk it back? Like, forget never. The bottles. That never happens. Like, yeah. And on top of the bottle situation, does it happen? The SEC is just lucky that that didn't change the outcome of the game, that Texas didn't come back and win it, that if it was, you know, the other way around, like Georgia only wins that game because of that a call or something like that. They're just lucky it's a minor, relatively minor talking point in the outcome of that game, and it didn't change it drastically.
Hold on a minute. Bingo. I had the Buffalo Wild Wings commercial on my Hubs bingo card today.
That's what it felt like. But I mean, think about the last couple of weeks in this league. You got a head coach who shoved a player. Okay.
He didn't realize he shoved him.
I mean, I'm not saying he Woody hazed him, okay? That's not that. But he shoves a player, there's no punishment there, and then the officials, as Grant, you know, so correctly put it out, make a call, walk it off. Hey, we're getting ready to play. Whoa, wait a minute, let's talk about this. Who told me to talk about it? Somebody told me to talk about it. Wait a minute, we're gonna change this. I mean, it's not a good look at all. And a bad precedent.
Well, so then Tennessee fans would say in a post-game press conference, Josh Heupel, if it's, you know, bad officiating, Josh Heupel should go off on these officials because nothing's going to happen.
Sure, and you should. I mean, yeah.
Kirby Smart, what I said last week.
I mean, Kirby Smart said whatever he's wanted to say. What are they going to do to him?
You got to channel your inner Jim Mora is what you got to do.
Jim Mora Jr. or Jim Mora Sr.?
Jr. Did you see him Saturday? Yes.
Oh, we saw him.
Jim Mora Sr. is the G-rated version. Junior is the R-rated version. So I wasn't sure which direction you were going there. I didn't know if you were going diddly poo or if you were going some harsh language.
Voldog 8. Have you ever seen a Bama crowd that small at Neyland Stadium, Grant?
Well, I was going to say, I told that to Grant in the pregame.
No, because I've really only been around covering the team since 2012-ish, and that's been the prime of Alabama. And all, I mean, it looks like insane numbers of Alabama fans in the stadium every time they come up here. But you know what, Alabama, welcome to how the other half lives. Like, this is reality for everybody else. Like, I don't think it's like panic time on Kalen DeBoer and, you know, fire him and start over and you messed up. Like, I think he'll be fine down the road, but man, welcome to how the other half lives.
Nashville wants to know, why not have Mike Matthews working in the slot for the next 2 weeks and roll him out versus Kentucky? Squirrel is hurt, not played well. Nimrod has not been great. Keep hearing he's an outside guy, but basically same size as Hyatt. Speed that can hurt the defense. Play him now. Before, Brent, you chime in on this, I'll go ahead and say, Nimrod, he's an outside guy, sure. So is Chaz Nimrod. And they put Chaz Nimrod in the slot, and he's a slot now. But, like, Chaz Nimrod's an outside guy, too, so just because he's an outside guy doesn't mean they can't rep him for a couple weeks and change him, right? I mean, he's talented enough to do that.
I got no comment. He played 5 snaps Saturday, so until they're ready to play him more snaps, I don't think he's a part of the conversation right now.
This is great. Hubs has got his line. He's got his standard line. He's like the politician.
Listen. Here's the thing. I think Mike Matthews is super talented. I don't know where he's at.
Did you grow up in a middle class family, Hubs?
No. Shut up. I don't know where he's at in terms of, knowing the offense, understanding.
I don't care.
Understanding all the offense or not. But they've talked about him for weeks, right, AP? I mean, he's going to be a factor. He's going to.
Well, that's all I heard. Exactly. I heard it from over there. He's going to play. He's going to play big down the stretch.
And listen, they're all making large sums of money to make decisions on who plays. They clearly don't think he's ready at this point to help them.
Yeah.
Given the injuries that they've had, so we'll see if in 2 weeks he can learn something or whatever he has to do to prove that he can get on the field. But until he gets on the field, I'm not counting on anything from Mike Matthews. I'm not because they don't feel – it's pretty obvious they don't feel very comfortable playing in situations. 5 snaps is all he played.
Here's a decision that needs to be made for them by the VolQuest podcast. Squirrel White, I appreciate your toughness, respect you like crazy for trying to play through the pain. But if you're diving for balls and you get up and you can't move your arm, if you're playing one arm at wide receiver, Like, I don't know that you're helping your team. Like, you got to walk that line between, are you helping your team, or, you know, it's great you're being tough and trying to help, but that toughness, if you're playing one arm wide receiver, I don't know if you're helping your team. And I think they're better right now with other guys in there.
And Grant Ramey, clearly not a squirrel wide guy.
Is what no, right I said all due respect to squirrel.
I said the same thing on the podcast, and clearly I'm not a squirrel wide guy either. So to your point, and I agree completely, Grant, the slot position right now is not good enough, and squirrel's hurt, and Chaz Nimrod has not played great. So he played five snaps, Mike Matthews did, put him in the slot, rep him for 2 weeks, and put him out there and play. I mean, it's just not good enough right now. So, I mean, that's bye week, perfect time to rep it.
Yeah, listen, you can be the greatest Squirrel White fan on the planet, and if he's limited because of the injuries, I mean, like, you know, it's like, it'd be like telling Michael Jordan, you know, hey, man, you know, I know you can't jump or use your right hand. You've got to go out and do it all from the ground with left hand. Like, or, you know, I mean, Larry Bird did that in the game, by the way.
Michael Jordan, probably not a good comparison there.
Well, no, but even then, like,
he had the flu hangover limited, game. Yeah.
Still limited. Like, the point is, like, I mean, the pass, like, was it on the first drive? It was in the first quarter, you know, where he, like, just reached out with one hand. You felt like if he'd have stuck two out, he probably catches that ball. And Grant's right. I mean, how many times against Florida did he get up with his shoulder hanging? You know, I mean, he's gutting through it. It's incredible toughness. Yep. I mean, kudos to the kid. But, like, you know, at the same time, like, is he hurting, you know, the team by being out there as much as he's been out there?
And to me, it's, yeah, kudos to Squirrel. He's a warrior. Like, that's, like, you want somebody like that on your team. But, like, where's an assistant coach saying, okay, hey, we got to get him off the field? That's where I'm at. I mean, assistant coach needs to step up and say, all right, we need to put somebody else in there. That's kind of – because Squirrel will say he's good when he's not, you know? AP's 7-iron. Is Ethan Davis one of the people that has been affected the most by the offensive line woes up until Saturday? Seemed like we've seen so much more of him in the offensive line when it plays much better.
Yeah, when they went to 12 personnel, I mean, it's been Kitzelman and Stays for the most part. Now, he did play a lot more Saturday. Even when he, you know, wasn't on routes, I mean, they had him in there to block a little bit more. So, you know, you hope that that's a part of his game that he's getting better at and that they're starting to trust him more on, because he is super talented, Brent.
Yeah, and I think with the uncertainty at the slot position, if you're limited, I think part of the reason why we saw Ethan Davis more was Squirrel White was out. And so now you've got Chaz Nimrod. Well, who's your other slot? Well, we don't really have another slot, so what do? Schematically, you play your tight end in that position a little bit. And I think that's part of the reason why you saw Ethan Davis a little bit more. So that's part of your personnel adjustment. And those are things they got to figure out this open date on how they're going to manage that down the stretch. I do think the last 2 weeks, obviously, they've got Davis more involved, and I think he can help them. But when they go straight to, you know, two tights and that personnel grouping to run the football, they're going to lean on Stays and Kitzelman, because both of them are more physical than Ethan Davis. Although Davis, I do think, is improving some as a blocker, but they've leaned on those two guys because they've been the more physical players.
AP, can you power rank your irons for us? Where's the 7 fall in?
That's pretty good. You know, 6 to pigeon weight, just pretty good. After the longer the club, the more erratic I become.
That's why he hits hybrids from anything from 6-iron down. He hits all those old man 30-degree hybrids.
So
like
true.
The rest of us do, right?
So true.
That's what you should be hitting. The heck with the 3-iron, man. That's a pointless club. No one should be hitting a 3-iron.
Amen to that. Or my 5-iron, which is, you know,
a three iron's like trying to play the slot with one arm.
Aikens VFL 24. Is there concern that any freshman that hasn't played a key role yet is going to look to transfer? Seems like we are super young at some spots and some seniors. And or guys leaving, there would be plenty of playing time next year.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again,
it's everywhere kids, too. Not just here, yeah, it's everywhere.
It's not a Tennessee thing. Everywhere, all those kids come in and they've been told they need playing time early, and they're going to all this. That's as tale as old as time. And some kids actually do get to that point if they're ready, if coaches think they're ready, and then some don't. And you know, they've got to, you know, kind of make it. I was talking to Ricky Gibson when we taped Ball Club Confidential for next week's show. And, you know, I said, we were talking about the difference between last year and this year. And I said, I know you, you know, probably felt you were ready last year, you know, but you know, can you look back and go, you know, I probably wasn't really ready to play. And he was like, well, I think I was ready. And then he was like, but I don't know as much as I do now. So I guess I wasn't ready. Like, you know what I mean? Like when you, everybody want, doesn't want to just be transparent and admit things until they kind of just look in the mirror and go, you know, I wasn't ready to play a year ago. I played, I got out there, but like I wasn't truly ready. And so I think a lot of kids, you know, struggle with that because they're used to being the king of the castle in high school. And all of a sudden they're kind of relegated back to the freshman team, like, you know, back when you're 14 years old.
Well, and you're also all of your people at home are texting you, calling you, yep. Going, hey, man, I thought you played. I hadn't seen you out there. I mean, yep. What's the deal? You said you're going up there and you're going to play early and this, that, and the other, and don't see you. And then somebody, you know, was telling you, hey, man, I can get you this kind of deal at these other seven schools. Yep. And somebody falls for it and you don't get a deal at any of those seven schools. And I mean, it's harsh. I mean, it's the hard reality of it. And you got to be pretty strong as an individual, but it's not a Tennessee thing. I mean, everybody in the country's dealing with it. And they're sometimes making a move is the right thing for some people. And other times making a move is the wrong thing. Every situation is totally different and no two situations are exactly the same. But all young kids are going through that part right now. Homesick, people ask you where you're at, you're not playing, what am I doing? You know, is grass greener on the other side? And that's just the reality of the world we live in.
It's every walk of life too. I mean, I remember my first year doing radio, I thought I was good enough to host my own radio show. Clearly I was not. 2 years later, I absolutely was. But that first year, nope. I thought I was, but I definitely wasn't. Orange Slice 78, great bye week question. What is the early watch list for positions likely needed in the portal based on development of underclassmen? Bonus questions, who were transfer out risk based on lack of playing time?
I'll start with the first one. I mean, first off, D-line, because they're going to have to restockpile that because you lose quite a few. You'd love to try to figure out how to keep Bryson Eason if you can. If he's willing to stay, they'll probably figure that one out to get him back. But I think defensive line, I think safety, you know, you're really set at corner, Hubs, but I could see them adding another Jalen McMurray type guy at a smaller school who wants to play up, but maybe is okay not starting next year because of who's in front of him, but will play, you know, on offense. You know, I'd tell you they'll go get a receiver, offensive line.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at a corner because where are you depth wise behind your two guys? I think that's a concern and a question. And where do you think Marcus Gorey, Caleb Beasley, those young guys are? Are they corners? Are they safeties? Are they nickel guys? I mean, what are those guys? I don't know the answer to that. That's a decision that you have to make in determining your portal stuff there. I think the interior defensive line is pretty fascinating and pretty interesting because if you got Eason back. And you got Hobbs, and you got Jack Boy, and you got Jamal Wallace. I mean, there's four there. You would certainly like to have another one, but do you have a young kid coming that you feel like? I mean, where's Nathan Robinson to help you? I mean, I don't want to say that's a luxury, but I don't know if you were to get Eason back. I don't know that is the necessarily premium portal grab that you thought it was going to be at the start of this year, but. I mean, Eason may be in the National Football League next year. We'll just have to see what he does. Yeah. I do think this, last 2 weeks, particularly last week, I thought Hobbs and Jackson Moy played their best football. And that's a positive sign moving forward for the back half of this season and for next year. I think you're starting to see some real development there, particularly with Hobbs.
I think Moy's a really good football player. He's flashed several weeks. And, like, where's Jamal Wallace? Like, we don't know right now, but, like,
I think they think he can help. He just doesn't have to help right now, which is a beautiful thing. I mean, that's
and they tried to do that playing with Moy, but he couldn't stay on the field.
Moy was too good. He was too ready to play.
Hey, we got plenty more questions to get into, but first let's get a word from our friends over at Exterior Home Solutions.
Get Neyland loud this football season with Exterior Home Solutions, East Tennessee's first choice for exterior renovations.
That phone number is 865-524-5888 and online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. Local and trusted since 1999. We'll get back into the questions. Market Square Streaker. Word on the street is Chaz Lanier and Felix Akpara both went for 20-plus in the close scrimmage. Are you surprised the points weren't more spread around or that Akpara scored that much? Grant, can you put some water on the rumors there or validate them?
Well, it's fertilize not
it, Grant. Fertilize it. Let's put them all in All-American status.
It's not straight 40 minutes of scrimmage basketball. Like, it's not a straight game. It's some game. It's some situational stuff. So
is it like 10 and out scrimmage in football?
If Felix scored 20 plus, I'd like to see the film of how he scored 20 plus. Now, the Tennessee coaching staff does not think that they're going to fall off a ton production wise from that center spot. He's going to score it much differently than Jonas Adu scored it. Obviously, Jonas was a lot of mid-range jumpers and stepping out and shooting it a little bit and just a little bit more finesse, I guess, around the rim, whereas Felix is more physical. He's going to play above the rim. He's going to catch more lobs from Zakai. He's going to score off putback, stuff like that. So they think he can score. I would be surprised if he has many games where he's scoring 20-plus, and if he did against Davidson, I would like to see the film and see how he did it. Chaz, not really, because – he can shoot the crap out of the ball, for lack of a better word. Like, he's that good of a shooter and a scorer. I assume it's going to translate at this level. We'll see. I don't think it's fair to think he's going to be Dalton Connect 2.0 from the jump, but he scores it, and he scores it in bunches. And I'm not surprised that he played well, because we've heard about him shooting it well all summer into the fall. But Felix, I'm going to have to see it to believe it. I think he's more defense and physicality, all that stuff.
Mr. Rocky Top Rowdy, does UT pipe in crowd noise in a Neyland Stadium?
No. Here's the beauty of college football is the Alabama radio can just throw that out there. Tennessee can say, no, we don't do that. A.J. McCarron can say, yes, you do. Other people say, no, we don't. Like, that's the beauty. It can just go back and forth. Now, he gets paid to talk and choose his words wisely. I think what he was trying to say was they play music between snaps like every other stadium in the country, and the band's playing and all that
stuff. I don't think that's
I don't think that's what he was saying, Grant.
I think what he said is exactly what he meant.
Yes.
And here's the thing.
Maybe I'm just – I give the people the benefit of the doubt too much.
Whoever is Alabama's starting quarterback in 2 years, you can thank Chris Stewart, because they're going to play Chris Stewart up there on the Jumbotron saying that stuff, and it'll just rile the crowd up even more 2 years from now. So, you know, you can thank him later.
I don't know exactly what he was saying or what the context or whatever. I just think it was an example of just kind of where
getting out over your skis.
Well, and I think it's an example of where Alabama is right now, right? Like it's suddenly become, quote, hard. Okay. Compared to where they've been. Right. Like you're just, you know, you're sitting there going, wait a minute. You keep waiting. Alabama fans just keep waiting for it. Okay. We always win in the fourth quarter, right? Like, we always take care of business. And I mean, and I like Chris. I've known Chris for a long time. And Chris, in his second year of that job, he inherits a team that goes to the playoff. They play for a title every year. And now all of a sudden, he's had two games where he covered a loss. You know, he's called a loss in Nashville, and he's called another loss at Tennessee. And I just think that it's one of those deals where their frustration sometimes creeps in. And, you know, when you've been on the air for 4.5 hours, sometimes you say stuff you shouldn't say. And I think that's one he'd like to have back. Well, whatever context he meant, I think he'd like to have it back, Greg.
I'm pretty sure this was like the second play of the game when it was this second was in the 16. First
quarter. Was it really?
Yeah,
because it was still light outside. Obviously, it's still bright in the booth. There was also a clip from when Tennessee basketball won down there in Tuscaloosa last season, where he was not happy with Dalton Connect using foul language on the court, which is a very strange hill to die on, considering – you know, big-time college athletes kind of tend to use a little bit of foul language sometimes.
Well, and considering one of Alabama's players was involved in the whole murder thing, like, you know, to some degree, right? I mean, like, you know, at least, you know, being thought of. I mean, like, that's – why throw stones? Why throw stones?
Just call the game.
All the game.
All the game.
But what we did learn here is that they broadcast – a YouTube stream from the booth, so we're going to need a Hubs cam from the Ball Network.
Oh, yeah, baby, that's coming. I mean, if you already saw Bob's got a camera up there now. That's coming.
I can guarantee you this. There will never, ever in my lifetime be a Hubs cam of Hubs in the booth live stream YouTube on a radio Ball Network.
We could get you a hat with a GoPro that sits out here in front of you.
But can you guarantee there won't be a camera up there where we see you at some point, though, on a taped? We're going to show it after the fact. Maybe
I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to be on a camera. I'm just going to tell you.
We got a camera in the Rivalry Thursday booth.
I don't think I'm going to be on a camera.
And it's mostly me doing this. Because Eric's hijacked the broadcast talking the whole time.
Yes, exactly.
And you're making a tea time, or you're ordering a You're ordering a private flight to go see.
I'm ordering one of my new Lank t-shirts. Losses at Nashville and Knoxville.
All right, let's move on here. Let's go to Vulcan. Is Tennessee the highest ceiling team in the SEC? The Vols are 6-1, haven't played one complete game during the SEC schedule. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Tennessee is, I think, it's a pretty good football team. Clearly, the offense isn't playing where it needs to play. If you put those two pieces together and add in special teams, I think Tennessee can be much, much, much better.
If Tennessee ever has that, if Nico ever has that moment, right, yeah, no matter who it's against, Mississippi State, Kentucky, Vanderbilt, Georgia, whoever, and the defense keeps playing, Tennessee was going to run somebody out of the stadium in a hurry. Like, if he ever has one of those games where it just clicks, it's going to be over in a blink.
You know, you and I were talking on the pregame two-minute drill about, like, this is why you come to Tennessee. This is why you get Nico, like, for this moment. And, like, I know what you're saying. He didn't have that game for sure. He had a couple of those moments, though.
Moments, in the second half.
Yeah, but not that game from start to finish. But I'm with you. If that ever happens, it'll be like LSU 22.
I was listening to y'all on the podcast a couple days ago talking about Nico missing those throws. I would be much more concerned if we had not seen him put those throws on the money through the first three, four games of the season. And I don't really think that the opponent necessarily is a factor, because an open receiver is an open receiver. Like, I think he's going to get back to it at some point. Like the hub stats about what he did after he ran that 27-yarder in the day after, I thought was really good too. I think he's going to get back to it at some point. I would just be more concerned if we hadn't seen it happen at all, which we have seen it happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you're sitting there and you watch him throw that ball to Dante Thornton, and you watch him drop that dime into Chris Brazel, and you're like, okay, it's there. I mean, it's just whatever mechanically he did wrong or was doing wrong in the first half. That's an easy fix, because you don't throw those two balls out of luck, right? Like, that's just, I mean, there's too much evidence. There's been too many people talk about his accuracy. We've seen it to go, okay, well, that's the luckiest throw I've ever seen on the run to Dante Thornton. You know, I mean, it's just, so you know it's there. It's just whatever he's missing when the guy's 5 yards wide open, he's got to fix that. That shouldn't be the hardest fix in the world for him to do, which I think is why you don't sit here and go, well, you know, seven games in, he is what he is. You know, I think that's a very fixable thing, because it's not consistent of who he's been since he's been at Tennessee.
Here's a question from Kaner_Eric, just for fun. Which throw was more difficult? The sprint out 55 yards on the line, or
that one,
the 16-yard drop it in a bucket back of the end zone? I think both are obviously difficult in different ways, but both really impressive. What do y'all say?
The one Thornton, because he's moving in your natural, he's almost moving forward, right? And so, like, I just thought that one was way more.
I'm with you. I would have went that play too.
The end zone, obviously, it's later in the game, and it's a tighter window in terms of where you have to place the ball. So I think that one, you could make some arguments, but it was more of a clean pocket, just step up and throw it to the end zone right there, as opposed to he's on the run all the way down the field as far as Dante was. I don't know what the ball covered in the air, but it was a 55-yard pass altogether. I mean, just the way he was running. That circumstance there where you're down, it's third down, you need a play to make that play, and that Dante catch too, man. That was a pretty elite catch as well.
I don't know how many times you practice the Dante throw and catch. Like, I don't know how many times in practice you go, okay, we're going to sprint half row, third and eight, throw it in a window 52 yards downfield on the run, on a full sprint. That's the play call, right? We get in the huddle. All right, here we go. You know, this is what we're going to do. The throw to Chris Brazel, I mean, we're not allowed to film it, but even in the preseason, they throw that pass to a spot every day in practice. Like, that is a skilled throw they work on. It is a very difficult throw, but you know that they practice that one. I don't know how much they practiced exactly what he did with Dante Thornton. I mean, that was...
It was almost like backyard, and
yeah, that was
Nico just saying, dude, just go. Like,
just go make a play. Yeah, I mean, just go, and I'll hit you. I mean, that's why I think that one is, I won't say luck, but that was not one they routinely work every day, I would not imagine, on the practice field. And even they said afterwards, we had that play in that week, but we ran it differently in the game. It was a different look. It ran a little different than how we had practiced that particular play most of the week. So sounds like he was probably supposed to set his feet to some degree and didn't. It was a heck of a throw.
The first time this year that we've seen, to my knowledge, a true sprint out. We've seen rollouts. That was a true sprint out. Gator Dog, first coach to leave / step down / fired in the SEC this year.
The easy answer would be Billy Napier, but I'm going to go off the cuff here. Because of what I referenced earlier. I'm going to say it's either going to be Mark Stoops or it's going to be Hugh Freeze.
In terms of just one of those two losing, getting fired, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Step down or whatever. Yeah.
Which SEC program right now loses its head football coach before the season's over first?
Yeah, I don't know.
The easy answer is Napier.
Yeah, because
he might save his job.
They've played well the last few weeks.
I agree. I'm fascinated to see what they do when they go to Texas next weekend. When Tennessee plays Kentucky the same day, when they go to Texas, how do they play?
I will say this. I mean, I don't know Billy Napier from Adam's house cat. Like, I'd have never sat down and visited with the kid and talked to the guy or whatever. But I am impressed with what he has gotten done because, I mean, that guy's coaching obituary was written in September. Like, everybody was sitting at their computer ready to hit send on the story multiple times. And, man, he's been able to hold that team together and keep them together. And they've played, you know, they've made an improvement. And they've
It was written with that invisible ink from the Andy Griffith Show.
I'm just saying. I mean, Grant, everybody had him done. And he's, you know, that team did not fall apart in the locker room.
Hey, Grant, backup quarterback, that's your future. Montrell Johnson didn't play. I mean, he's doing it with some guys that'll be there next year too. So that, I think that's important.
Seems like the quit factor in Kentucky is very, very high. I didn't know Adam had a house, let alone a house cat.
He does.
You learn stuff on this podcast.
Our guy P. Fortenberry wants to know, Austin, your current top five courses you've played.
Nobody wants to hear that.
Warrior's Path.
Ask it. He wants to know.
Oscars.
It's changed names. It's changed names. New ownership, changed names. Maybe even getting an extra nine when we go to 18 holes up there in Morristown. Shinnecock, Augusta, Fisher's Island, Chicago Golf Club,
Patriot Hills.
Warriors Path.
We're going to do that. Then we got to mention Clinchview, which is where I worked growing up, and I have fond and dear memories from.
We miss Lost Creek greatly.
Lost Creek, pour one out.
The pride of Talbot.
Pour one out. Newmarket.
Onward we go.
Newmarket. How many times have you got? Hold on. Before we go any further, how many times have you gotten popped for a speeding ticket in Newmarket?
Oh my God! Like three times in my life.
Mitch couldn't get you out of that.
That's Newmarket, man. That's not his jurisdiction.
Me and AP both worked at golf courses growing up.
I bet we had two
very, very different jobs. Yes, I was edging bunkers and cutting tee boxes and changing whole locations. I was on the greens crew, baby.
Landscaping at home better be great.
I was a carboy, but all the carboys had to go out and pick up pine cones in the spring. And so we go out there and we're like, you know, it looks like, you know, we're doing like for a body search. Like we're like walking down the fairway, like, you know, arm's length. And my dad, who is a, you know, work great smarter guy. Than a harder guy, great he is guy. The best. He gives me his little thing where you push the button and it clamps down and it's like you can pick up stuff with it. And so I'm walking down there and I'm picking it up like this. And those guys were so mad at me. They still give me a hard time about that to this day for like, you know, they were all having to bend down and pick them up. And I'm just like, you know, picking them up.
I worked for an excavator one summer when I was in college. And I was like, what do you want me, or when I was in high school, I was like, what do you want me to do? And he's like, you're just going to pick up rocks. And I'm like, okay. I show up, literally gives me a bucket. I'm picking up chunks of concrete all day long.
I worked at a funeral home. That's a whole different podcast.
LFVol, what is your perspective on tight end without using coach speak, consistency, or physicality? Why is 87 getting the vast majority of the snaps given the grade so low, and isn't it showing up much? Are we at risk of losing Davis? Brent, I think they're most comfortable with Kitzelman, and I think he can do more overall in their game, and that's why he's played so much.
Well, I have no idea why Miles Kitzelman stopped on the Dylan Sampson fumble. Okay,
Me neither.
I mean, I have no idea. Looks like he didn't know the play or didn't know it was coming to his side. I have no idea why he stopped on that play. But aside from that, to suggest that Miles Kitzelman hasn't played well, I think is unfair. I think he's done a lot of solid things for Tennessee. And, you know, they're comfortable with him as an inline, most physical tight end. blocking guy. I mean, you go back to Dylan Sampson's 26-yard touchdown run against Florida, which was a pin and pull. Kitzelman blocks the end, then gets to the inside linebacker to where Carrick can get to the outside linebacker, and then Lance Hurd has got the safety. Like, typically that's blocked up, that it's Dylan Sampson versus a safety one-on-one in the open field.
Because Hurd's getting one of the backers.
Yeah. Right, but because Kitzelman took the inside backer out, as well as the defensive end, Hurd gets to the safety level. So that's an example of playing that play perfect for Kitzelman. I think he's done better than the question presumes. Has he been perfect? Has he been great? No. But I think Tennessee feels like he's given them the best chance to be successful in the run game on the most consistent basis.
AP, I think it just goes back to the tight end position in this offense is so much more than running routes and catching passes. And that's what Ethan Davis as well. And I think, you know, he's grown so much more in the, I know that the poster doesn't want us to use physicality, but in that area of what it takes to be a tight end in this offense. But truly, you've got to be able to do so many different things, and Kitzelman just ahead of the other two, and that's why he's played the most.
You do, but I would also say that, you know, I think that you have to find a way to get certain players on the field. You know, even if their skill set may hurt you in certain areas, you've got to find a way to, you know, get them out there.
When you're trailing.
A la Mike Matthews, a la Boo Carter. I mean, Boo Carter at the beginning of the season wasn't seeing as much playing time as, you know, he is now. But now it's Katie bar the door.
Yeah, like points and times in the, like Arkansas, I remember specifically, like points and times in the second half, you're down, you need a score, and you're running doubles. You got 11 personnel out there, but you're running doubles. You don't have an inline tied in. And it's Kitzelman out there. Like, why on earth is Ethan Davis not out there in that situation? Like, that's...
Here's the thing, though. And I've been around Hubs long enough. This is going to be a Hub stop comment. What has Ethan Davis done to this point in his career to make you think that oh, you just stick him out there and he's going to go get it done? Like, it's not like he's just been super productive in the passing game. You know, and in fact, Kitzelman has done just as much as he has. Now, granted, I get it. Miles has had more reps over the course of the year than Ethan Davis has. But, I mean, it's not like Ethan Davis has been out there, you know, just being Travis Kelce and Gronkowski. Am I right in that, Hubs, or am I wrong?
No, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, the reality is their strategy on defense with rotating guys and their strategy on offense with rotating guys is just different.
Yep.
It's different. I mean, Tennessee made a commitment from week one, we're going to play Boo Carter, okay? And they basically equal snapped him and Christian Harrison from day one of this season. That's how we're going to bring him along. Yeah, there's some things he can't do, but we're going to ride through it. We're going to deal with the things he messes up, and we're going to grow from that, and we're going to improve and go from there. Look at what they've done with Jalen Smith, right? Jalen Smith plays week two, and we're all going, wait a minute, I'm playing Jalen Smith. Well, guess what? They have to have him there. They played Caleb Herring in critical situation off the edge on Saturday. You know, the fact that they played Jalen McMurray early in the year gave them an opportunity that Jalen McMurray wasn't lost when he was forced into the game late on Saturday because Jermod McCoy wasn't able to play and wasn't able to go. Their approach on defense is a different approach to what the offensive rotation has been. Now, if the offense were playing really well, maybe it would look totally different. But right now where the offense is, the number of guys playing in rotation seems to be shrinking a little bit as you try to find a way to score in the first half and get things in a better rhythm.
Artie Vall wants to know, at 10-2, are there any bigger dominoes that Tennessee needs to fall than A&M and LSU losing two more games, Notre Dame losing another, the chaos in the ACC so that they only get one bid? Essentially, what needs to happen? What do Tennessee fans need to be rooting for this weekend during the bye and over the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I mean, you root for Army, you root for Navy, because if they're winning, they're taking care of Notre Dame. You're rooting, I think, for South Carolina. You know, I think in a perfect world, A&M beats LSU, then South Carolina beats A&M. You know, I think, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, they're going to turn the calendar to November, Brent, and either LSU or A&M are going to be undefeated in conference play with five games to go, which, I mean, you know, I don't think anybody saw that when LSU lost to USC, it was 3-4, and A&M lost to Notre Dame.
Yeah, I mean, Grant, I just think that at this point, you know, you probably just need as much chaos as you can possibly find. I mean, because Greg Sankey can talk about, you know, 6, 7, 8 teams in the playoff. That's not, I mean, it's just not realistic for what, I don't think the SEC is going to get that many. So you're going to need, you know, you need help, and then you've got to go take care of your business if you're Tennessee. You know, because if you're sitting there with a 2-loss team, all the 2-loss teams are going to need help, Grant, and in some capacity.
They are, and I think you know, the BYUs of the world, the Iowa States, those kind of teams, I think you need to be rooting for chaos there. And you need, like Oklahoma State, they couldn't finish off BYU the other night. You need that kind of loss to happen for those kind of teams. Texas A&M is interesting because you still got to play Texas at the end of the year. If one of those two teams, being LSU or Texas A&M, goes to Atlanta for the SEC championship game, I don't think going there really helps you. I think you stand to lose a lot more than you gain there, unless you can beat a Georgia or whoever else is down there playing for the SEC title. But Tennessee, just be 10-2, take care of business, and hope for as much chaos and 2-loss, 3-loss teams that you're going to be arguing spots for based on your resume. It's just like college basketball in March.
I would tell you, one, I think whoever goes to Atlanta or Indianapolis for the Big Ten, whoever plays for the conference title in a, when there's no divisions, those teams are in. I don't think you can really do any damage to yourself, maybe seeding, but I mean, I don't think that you're going to be in and then lose the championship game and be out. I think you're in at that point.
I don't.
If you trust the ESPN calculations and all that crap, Tennessee's chances at 10-2 is like 75% to 80%.
Okay.
If you factor in a loss to Georgia or Texas or whoever in Atlanta, it drops to like 30%. But I mean, that's a computer simulation. Who knows how legit it is?
10-2 at 66.7% right now.
Oh no, I get it. I'm just saying, like, I think if you're in Atlanta, you're in. I don't think they're going to penalize that team. If that means you finished ahead of the teams that are 10, like let's say LSU gets.
Let's use Indianapolis. So Ohio State, Indiana play for the Big Ten championship. Indiana gets beat 3 scores. They're a lock. They're a lock for the playoff with that schedule that they played all year long. You don't punish them for losing a game to their first ranked opponent or one of their few ranked opponents they've played. They're a lock to be in.
Well, I don't think they can get there because they got to play Ohio State in the regular season. Okay. And Ohio State, you know, but like, I mean, but the point is, let me re-preface. If you go to Atlanta, let's take Indianapolis out. If you go to Atlanta, I think you're a lock.
I think what AP's saying is if there's 4 SEC teams in the playoff and the 2 teams in Atlanta are 2 of the best teams in the league, the 2 best teams in the league based off of records and tiebreakers and all that, then those 2 teams should be in the playoff regardless.
Like, let's say Tennessee, for this argument's sake, let's say Tennessee goes 11-1. And then you have a bunch of other teams sitting there at 10-2. But then Tennessee loses in Atlanta, but let's say 17. I think you're in because you did enough in the regular season to get to Atlanta more so than the teams that were 10-2. Same thing here. Like, if somebody gets to Atlanta ahead of Tennessee, I think that team isn't going to be penalized and drop below out of the playoff over a 10-2 team because they did more than the other 10-2 teams because they were able to get to Atlanta.
Okay, I think if a 10-2 team gets to Atlanta and loses,
let me give you this scenario.
Tough. Okay,
I don't even know if this scenario works out, but since we're playing all the hypothetical games, let's say Missouri wins out with 1 loss.
Okay,
Missouri goes to Atlanta. They play Georgia. Missouri gets beat. They're a 2-loss team. They deserve in over a 2-loss A&M team, a 2-loss Texas team, a 2-loss Tennessee team. That they've done more with their schedule. They're deserving as a 2-loss team because they made it to Atlanta with that schedule over other 2-loss teams that didn't play in the title game.
And you just debunked my theory with that one team. So there is a method to it, I think. Like, you're right in that situation. I think that you would be correct. But I think in the other situations I was describing with LSU, teams like that, I think that they're a lock. I think because based off their quality of win.
It depends on who you played in the regular season.
Yes.
I think your regular season schedule.
Because I mean, like, yeah. I mean, look at Notre Dame lost. Doesn't look that good. USC lost. Doesn't look that good. The loss to Arkansas doesn't look good for Tennessee. You know.
I think it's what you – I think you got to factor in the regular season part of that and not just say, well, they were in Atlanta, so they're automatically in just because you got to Atlanta. I think it depends on what your whole body of work looks like, which will be interesting to see. That's why this is going to be so chaotic in the month of November.
We've gone from arguing who's the fourth team and who's the fifth team to who's 8, 9, 10, 11, and the group of five team, which is incredible.
Which is exactly what the college football playoff
is. Yes, and I love it.
It's perfect. And that's why we're going to go to 16 teams, and in another 2 years we're going to be arguing who 14 through 16 should be.
It's a content gold mine.
And if you're Tennessee and you're Alabama or Ole Miss or LSU or A&M or any other, even Georgia or Texas, because they each have one loss just like Tennessee does, you're rooting for somebody to beat Miami between now and the ACC championship game. Yeah, that way, potentially.
That's why that was a multi-million-dollar review against Virginia Tech.
Yes, it was.
All right, last question. It's a two-parter, but I'm only going to ask for Tom's sake. I'm only going to ask the basketball one, Grant. It's from Volume Shooter. For those of us going to the basketball game on Saturday, what should we be looking for? Anything you guys noticed at practice that you're curious to see play out on the court in game-like situation? I'm going to add in there. Give us some nuggets from the Davidson scrimmage on Sunday as well.
I mean, Chaz shot it really well, played really well. Outside of that, who knows? It's what to expect Sunday. Or what you're looking for, what the rotations look like. I mean, this is a team with 11 scholarship players. The backup point guard stuff, you know, what does Chaz Lanier look like? Kind of in the bright lights against a big-time program like Indiana with people in the stands. Same with Igor Milicic, same with Felix Okpara. Obviously, he's played on big stages before, but just seeing what those guys look like. It's a brand-new roster. You lost four guys in the portal. You added four guys in the portal. You only returned six guys. What's J.P. Estrella look like? Cam Carr, Cade Phillips. Those are three sophomores that you're going to have to rely on heavily because you're limited numbers-wise. They're going to have to be very versatile. I mean, Rick's talked about that. They can play four guards. They can play three bigs, basically three forwards. So they can do a lot of different stuff. But basically, I'm just looking to see what they look like for 40 minutes, what the combinations look like, all the different ways they try to play. And you got Igor Milicic, who's a 6'10 forward who can step out and shoot it. And has a ton over the last couple of years, and Rick's never had that in his offense. So I'll be interested to see what he looks like and kind of how he plays.
Appreciate you guys sending in those questions, as you do each and every week here on the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast. Big thanks to our friends over at Exterior Home Solutions for being a proud presenting sponsor of the show, 865-524-5888, online at exteriorhomesolutions.com. They've been local and trusted since 1999. Got a lot going on the website this week. We've had tons and tons of recruiting coverage from AP and Matt on prospects who were on campus this past week, a couple of commits, and we got a lot of content coming the rest of the week on into the weekend. And then Brent Hubbs at Tennessee getting back into game week against Kentucky. Basketball starting up. You got fall baseball scrimmage that I'll be at on Friday night. A lot going on over the site right now on the GQ.
Yep, don't want to miss out on any of it. We're heading into crossover season, which is Grant's favorite time of the year, and we've got plenty of football, plenty of discussions. I mean, this whole playoff talk is going to continue for the next few weeks, and there'll be lots of scenarios to break down and discuss, as well as where is this team at and how does this offense grow, all kinds of stuff to dive into that we'll continue to do throughout this week and get you ready for Kentucky next week.
We're Austin Price, Grant Ramey, Brent Hubbs. I am Eric Kane. Thank you so much for joining us here on the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast.
You've been listening to the VolQuest Mailbag Podcast every week right here on VolQuest.